We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is the second hour of Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal. Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about why it is we put up historical monuments, how we think about them, and how the way that we think about them can change pretty dramatically over time. There are monuments scattered across this country. People pass by them every day and don't even give them a second glance. We often take these things for granted. But at the same time, it's true that many of our historical monuments, and that's true of ones that are in Washington as well as ones that are in cities across the country, have often been the subject of controversy. Same thing can also be said of the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Many people have complained that there are too many monuments there, although nothing seems to stand in the way of putting up new ones. This morning in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Kirk Savage. He is professor and chair of the Department of Art and Architecture at the University of Pittsburgh. And we'll be talking about his book, Monument Wars. It looks in part at how it is the National Mall became the monumental core of the nation, and about how the kind of monuments we put up and the way we think about them has changed very significantly over the time. He's the author of another book that deals with some similar issues. That's titled Standing Soldiers, Kneeling Slaves, Race, War, and Monument in 19th Century America. That book won the John Hope Franklin Prize in 1998 for the best book published in American Studies. And his new one, Monument Wars, is just recently out. It's published by the University of California Press. The subtitle on the book is Washington, D.C., the National Mall, and the Transformation of the Memorial Landscape. As we talk, questions certainly are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We do have a toll-free line, so if it would be long-distance call, use that one, 800-222-9455. And emails are welcome, too. You send them to will-talk, so that's W-I-L-L-talk, will-talk at illinois.edu. Professor Savage, hello.
Hello. Well, thanks for inviting me to speak with you today.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. I think it's really it's a fascinating subject, and I think it's good because, as I say, it's one of those things that encourages people to think about why we put these things up and about how that changes over time. And there is one particular, obviously one very large kind of change that you talk about in the book that we will be talking about. As a way of starting, I wonder what you can say about why it is we erect monuments.
Yeah, I know it's a simple question with a complicated answer.
Yeah.
Because the answers to that question have really changed over time. You know, in the most obvious way, people erect monuments in order to remember a person or an event, and that's what we typically think of when we erect a public monument. But at various times in the history of this country, the answer has been a lot more complicated because, for example, in the early history of the nation, when the first proposals for erecting monuments to George Washington were floated, you know, many people thought that it was totally unnecessary to erect a monument to Washington. You know, his memory was going to live forever. Who needed a monument, you know, to keep his memory alive? It would stay alive because the people would nourish that memory themselves. So there was a lot of controversy even at that time about why a monument to a major hero should be erected and whether it was a waste of, you know, money and resources and so on. So other people have, you know, at that time argued that, oh, no, we must erect a monument to Washington because we have to show our gratitude as a nation to him. And moreover, we want to kind of, by erecting a monument, we're going to inspire young people to, you know, emulate his achievement. And that was essentially, you know, the rationale for the heroic monument was that kind of idea that by dotting the cities of the country, and particularly the capital of the country, with these great sculptures of individual heroes, that it would inspire citizenship and patriotism, particularly among the young people of the country. Over time, that rationale has changed, and you know, after the Civil War, people began to think about erecting monuments to ordinary people, not great men, you know, who were famous, but ordinary soldiers, because they thought that if they didn't erect the monument, their names would be lost forever. These ordinary men, you know, who served their country from a town in Illinois or Massachusetts or wherever, their names would go up on a war memorial starting, you know, in the late 19th century. This practice started because the people of that town, particularly the veterans who served in those wars, were actually afraid that their service would one day be forgotten, and the memorial was going to be a way of keeping that alive. And the ironic thing, of course, about this whole phenomenon is that monuments themselves then become forgotten and become, in a sense, obsolete. And so despite the fact that they're meant to be permanent reminders of the, you know, heroic achievements or the great service of particular people, they do actually require communities and societies to keep them alive. You know, to go to visit the monuments, to fold them into their kind of community rituals, in order for that process of remembering actually to continue taking place.
Yeah, then I guess here, just to underscore the point, I think that one of the big changes has been that we don't put up monuments anymore so much thinking that whatever statement it is we think we're making is this will stand forever as a testament to something, some person, some event, some set of values, whatever.
Right.
But as you say, the problem is that time passes, and then eventually people come and they stand in front of it and they say, what's this for? Or maybe they don't even stand about in front of it at all. They just walk by it. And although in the way that we do monuments, do we allow for that? Or is that something that you'd have to say that you actually can't really do anything about?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. That's actually become a subject of a lot of discussion among people who design monuments and the committees that that decide on designs and the regulatory agencies that oversee them, particularly in Washington. A newer idea is emerging that precisely the remark that you made, that monuments really cannot, as much as they pretend to be permanent, they really can't be, because the society changes around them, and even the very landscape that they're built in often changes enormously around them. So now designers and people who think about monuments are trying to kind of build designs that allow the monument itself to evolve over time and allow its significance to change over time. And this is something that you'll see frequently in discussions, for example, about the September 11th memorial in New York. You know, the idea in the mission statement there was that the monument should evolve over time. So they didn't want to create some kind of fixed icon, you know, like the steel girders in the form of a cross. That had emerged at Ground Zero. They didn't want to create anything like that was too limited and fixed in its appearance and in its meaning, but try to create something that was more open to interpretation, so that interpretation would in fact evolve over time. Now that is very much of a late 20th century, early 21st century idea of what a public monument should be, because before that time, it was precisely, you know, we want to make a statement, we want the statement to last forever. And now that's quite different. And the whole idea that a monument should be a space that is experienced rather than a fixed message that you receive, like a history lesson, but instead a space where people come and experience emotions about that event and in fact, even heal, particularly when we're talking about commemorating a traumatic event like the Vietnam War or September 11th. An entirely different rationale had emerged then, where the monument was to be part of a healing process, again, something that would have been completely foreign to people in the 19th or early 20th century.
Our guest is Kirk Savage. He's professor and chair of the Department of Art and Architecture at the University of Pittsburgh. And we are talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his recent book, Monument Wars, subtitled Washington, D.C., the National Mall and the Transformation of the Memorial Landscape. And it does concentrate mainly on the mall in Washington, which is maybe arguably the greatest concentration of memorial building anywhere in the country. Certainly it has pulled a lot of things together in a relatively small space. It talks about how it is that came to be, how the mall as it was in the 19th century is very different from what it is now. But also it gives us an opportunity to talk a little bit about monuments and what they're all about and how the way people have changed, how they think about that over time. We do have a caller here. We'll get right to questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller from Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I have, actually, three things. Number one, main one I'm interested in is there a way to sort of keep tap on the interest in monument keeping in terms of how much money we spend to repair them? I've been around a few places in Indiana, and sometimes I seek them out now to see what the monuments look like. Some of them have been defaced, the concrete, you know, is starting to go away. Instead of having a nose and a mouth, you know, you just sort of have a blank face, and things have been chipped at, and, you know, and sometimes, you know, you get kids to do things to them. I wonder if there's a thing there you can check to see what the sort of the personality of the situation is like. Number two, in terms of monuments that don't need to be up anymore, is say, I'm in the town of Logansport, and was Indian country, of course. Outside of our town, we have a huge concrete hunk that's a tribute, a memorial to six soldiers that died in an riff on an Indian village that just had women and children. There were no braves. And they killed them all, of course. And six guys died by falling off their horses. And now, of course, this is sort of it's an eyesore in some sense, but it's out in the boonies, so not too many people see it. But I went out and checked it, and it's starting to crumble. The concrete giving away because it's, you know, it's not being used, essentially. I wonder if you could speak to that. And the next question I just did, too, is are the treatment of monuments in the psyche the same as they were in Egypt or Greece? Thanks.
All right. Well, you can see if you can deal with any or all.
All right. Well, let's start with the issue of maintenance and how these monuments are maintained over time. That is a very pressing issue and really difficult one because, again, you know, the whole idea of when a monument was erected traditionally was that it would be erected in imperishable permanent materials, bronze or marble or granite, some kind of stone or metal, or combination of them. And people didn't really think about the issue of maintenance. They certainly didn't endow the monuments with a maintenance fund or things like that. Typically, it was the local government authority that the monument was given to or that erected the monument that was responsible for maintenance. And it's, you know, kind of low down on the priority list of most municipalities or state governments to take care of these things. There is a really wonderful organization now, a nonprofit called Save Outdoor Sculpture, which has, first of all, created a national database of trying to create a national database of every outdoor public monument, sculptural monument in the United States. And partly this is in order to track their condition and their maintenance and to help localities then come up with grant proposals and funding schemes to repair monuments and to keep them maintained. But it does get to, you know, the deeper issue of what is the meaning, the continuing meaning of these monuments in our in these local communities in which they were built. So, you know, the example that you gave of the six soldiers who died falling off their horses, and it's in a remote area. This is precisely the kind of I love examples like that. I'm really attracted to these, you know, kind of more offbeat monuments in remoter areas, and try to keep track of them actually on public sites like Flickr that post photographs of these kinds of things all over the place. But those sorts of monuments are precisely the kinds of ones that really slip into oblivion and don't really have a there's no one left to, in a sense, connect with those people who died and to maintain an interest in their memory and in preserving their monument. And that's, on a larger scale, that has happened with, for example, you know, monuments to World War I, which are very common all over, you know, the so-called doughboy statues that are common across the country that were erected in little towns but also larger cities across the country. You know, the World War I veterans have all died, and the kin networks that once supported those monuments, that actually erected the monuments and supported them in Memorial Day observances and things like that, they have so dissipated now that these monuments don't really mean much anymore in most local communities. And that's even happening. That's going to happen more and more with World War II memorials as well. And so this is a phenomenon, you know, that is just that's really widespread and is one of the kind of interesting things about how public monuments endure, you know, in our society. I guess the final question was about Egypt and, you know, ancient monuments, and I'm not an authority on the subject of ancient monuments, but they did provide some of the basic forms that were often then used. Particularly the early part of the history of this country, you know, the obelisk, the greatest example being the Washington Monument in Washington, which is this gigantic 550-foot tall obelisk. Well, the obelisk was, of course, an ancient Egyptian form, and it was transformed in Washington by being made much, much larger, but also being made out of, you know, thousands of stones, whereas the original ancient Egyptian prototype was a monolith, was a one single stone that was carved into the shape of this needle, usually about like 50, 60, 70 feet high. So those examples from antiquity still lived on and were copied and adapted, you know, by in the United States as well as in many other countries around the world.
I appreciate the comments of the caller. Let's go on and talk with someone else. In Champaign, line one. Hello. The caller there on line one in Champaign?
Yes.
Yes.
I'm intrigued by a statue that was in Enterprise, Alabama, erected to a boll weevil, and it was at the time and in the context of Dr. George Washington Carver making recommendations about the use of peanuts and sweet potatoes as alternative crops to cotton. But the monument was erected in Enterprise, Alabama, to the boll weevil because the boll weevil destroyed the cotton crop and people had to do other things. And I'm just curious to know if you are aware of any other monuments that have been erected to insects.
Wow, no, that's a new one for me. I have to say, I like to track monuments to animals. You know, I've seen monuments to dogs and horses, and particularly, you know, war memorials to animals that were killed in action. But as far as a monument to an insect, you've got me there. And in fact, I'm going to make a note of that for my own records, because I've never heard of that, and it not only is it interesting because it's a monument to an insect, but it's also a monument to a disaster as well. I'm very interested in the subject of disaster monuments, because that's also, again, a kind of new form of monument in the 20th century that hadn't existed previously.
Well, maybe we can talk a little bit about that. And now, in this particular case, I'm vaguely familiar with this, and I think, as the caller said, that it is a monument to a disaster, and yet at the same time, it's used to say that the disaster was maybe in some sense turned to people's advantage, because what it did was it got people away from this huge monocropping of cotton that was going on. But I know what you've said is that, generally speaking, we don't put up monuments to really bad things. There are some interesting exceptions, like, for example, the monument in Washington that marks the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. There, you know, that would have been a time we never would have put up something like that.
Right.
And we have the Holocaust Museum, which, you know, again, is to, I don't know if commemorate is the right word, to educate people about that event. Talk a little bit about monuments to disasters.
Yeah, that really intrigued me, because I after September 11th, 2001, fairly soon after that, there were a lot of calls for commemoration, for erecting monuments to the people who had lost their lives on that day in that tragedy. And I started thinking about this historically, and started thinking about whether this was, to what extent this was really a new idea. Because in my experience working with the source material in earlier time periods, people, there were tragedies. There were shipwrecks and hurricanes and yellow fever epidemics and so on. They didn't tend to be commemorated in public monuments. They might be remembered in a cemetery somewhere, but as far as a major monument or a civic monument in a town or along a street or something, it just didn't happen. And so I began to look into the history of this, and I think this is really something that has evolved over the 20th century. You begin to see local disaster memorials in the early 20th century, and then they become much more common in the late 20th century. You mentioned the Holocaust Memorial Museum, and of course the Holocaust as an event spawned many, many memorials around the world, and has spawned memorials in communities around the United States, and not just in that major museum monument in Washington, D.C. and it this shift from commemorating heroes, you know, men who, typically men who made their mark on history through some kind of great action, that shift, which was the original kind of heroic idea of the monument, to a monument that actually commemorates the victims of history and the victims of history's tragedies and traumas, is something that I see really developing in the 20th century. I see it in the developing in Washington on the Mall in the early 20th century, but then coming really to full flower at the end of the 20th century, so that now we've gotten to a point where it is really part of our common sense. It's sort of part of our new idea of the monument that, of course, if there's a tragedy, a major kind of civic tragedy, that there should be a monument to mark the victims of that tragedy. The Japanese American Memorial that you indicated is particularly unique, because not only does it mark a tragic event, but it also declares that we as a nation were culpable for that event. And it does say, there is an inscription in the monument itself that says, "Here we admit a wrong," which is the only monument that I know of that in the Capitol in Washington, D.C., that actually explicitly admits that we as a nation, as a government, were culpable in a major historical wrong.
Mm-hmm. We're at our midpoint in this hour of Focus. Our guest is Kirk Savage. He's professor and chair of the Department of Art and Architecture at University of Pittsburgh, and is the author of the book Monument Wars, which takes a look at the National Mall in Washington, D.C., how it is developed to be the place that it is, but also is an opportunity to think a little bit about monuments and why we put them up, how we relate to them, how the meaning of monuments sometimes changes over time, sometimes to the point where there, for people who are there at the time, is no meaning. The book is very interesting. It's just out now from the University of California Press, recently out. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm really interested in these changes in the way that we design the monuments, and you've talked about the shift away from the monument to the great man to the monument to the common man. But and also you mentioned that there has been this change so that now the sort of the point of the monument, one might say the monument itself, is the experience of it that we have.
Right.
At what point did that change happen, and how did that change happen?
Right. Yeah, that's, I think, probably the most central argument that I make in my book, which is, to put it in the most simple form, is that public monuments change from objects that we were meant to worship or revere in the old heroic model. They change from that to spaces in which we are meant to have experiences, spaces to experience rather than objects to revere. And that, there's a lot of things that are happening around in the late 19th and early 20th century that that combine to start that shift happening. But one is the emergence of really new ideas about space, and it's in the early 20th century that we really begin even to see the whole concept, the very term public space, really doesn't emerge in a major way until the 20th century. People start to think of space itself as something that is not mere emptiness. In the 19th century, space was just an empty area between things that were important. But in the 20th century, architectural theorists and many other kinds of people are starting to think of space itself as something that has a positive quality that kind of shapes us, and that shapes our experience of the world. And this then, when the planners who created the 1901, the landmark 1901 plan of Washington, D.C., the so-called Macmillan Plan, it's usually called, which would then shape the redevelopment, the development of the mall in the 20th century, they were really interested in creating, taking what had been a series of picturesque parks and gardens in the center of Washington. That's really what the mall had been in the 19th century. And they were interested in taking that and reshaping them as one big unified space that was going to actually represent the nation itself. And that this equation of the space with the nation was, I think, probably their most profound contribution. It was a profound contribution of that plan. And then it changed, in fact, even the way the monuments, individual monuments themselves were designed, so that they became thought of as more architectural and spatial compositions rather than simply figures of heroes on pedestals. Mm-hmm. That old idea of that heroic idea of the statue on the pedestal gave way to a new idea of creating an environment here in which a spatial environment in which you experienced the hero or the event. And that had, I think, enormous ramifications, because then that space itself became a kind of psychological space. The physical space became a psychological space in which people have experiences and actually start to think about in new ways about the historical event, the historical complexities of the event that are being remembered at that monument. And I'm thinking particularly of works like the Grant Memorial and the Lincoln Memorial.
Yeah, I'd say they probably of the two of the things that you would point to as an example of the very thing that you're talking about, those two would be great examples, and they're on opposite ends. The Grant is on one end, and and Lincoln is on the other. And here in the Lincoln Memorial, you have this enormous statue of Lincoln. So in a sense, it's a great man monument, and yet it's really not like what had gone before, and it has to do with the piece itself, with the major piece, and the response that people have to that, but also the space in which it's set.
Right, because it's part of now the link that figure of Lincoln. First of all, it's a kind of complex, kind of brooding figure, not a simple kind of triumphant figure of Lincoln, but one in which really actually sort of suggests the historical puzzles and dilemmas that he himself had to deal with. But then, as you say, it's set into this large space with the texts of two complete texts of two of his most famous speeches on either end of that large space. And so we not only do we go in and look at the statue, but we read the text and we think about the whole experience now in a much broader way, and it invites us to do that. And so it's inconceivable, you know, when Mr. Smith, the film, for example, Frank Capra's film, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, 1939. Well, the Lincoln Memorial plays this enormous role in the film, because that's where Jimmy Stewart, who plays Mr. Smith, that's where he goes to kind of where he goes at key kind of psychological points in the narrative. He has this kind of he has this experience at the memorial. Well, it's inconceivable to think about that happening at the earlier monuments to Lincoln that had been erected, you know, statues on pedestals. They just simply didn't invite that same kind of psychological intensity, you know, that a filmmaker like Capra was really, I think, smart to observe and pick up on.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that in a lot of ways the fulfillment of this trend, the continuation of that trend, we see it then in something like the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, which now is a really beloved, much visited place. And I think people forget that at the time it was quite controversial when it first was put up. A lot of people said that they didn't like it. In fact, that's probably an understatement a lot of people said.
It was enormously controversial because it didn't fit the old-fashioned idea of a heroic monument. And a vocal, I think it was actually a minority, but a very vocal minority of veterans wanted a monument that wasn't going to be below grade level, below ground level, that wasn't going to be in black granite, that would instead have recognizable heroic images of soldiers and flags and so on. I think it's because they didn't understand what the spatial experience of that monument was going to be like. And it wasn't until the monument was built and people started coming to it and experiencing it and then starting to leave their offerings at it, which became a kind of interactive space, not just a place where you go and look, but people touch the wall and make rubbings of the names and leave offerings and all that kind of stuff, so that the experience of the monument became complex at many levels, the emotional experience of the monument did. It wasn't until all that happened and people started kind of seeing how it worked that controversy and criticism really died down and to the point where we hardly remember it today. But you're right in the sense that monument then became, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial became, in a way, the new paradigm, you know, the new model of what this experiential monument was supposed to be like. And it's for that reason it's been so widely imitated and has become a kind of benchmark for what we think of as an appropriate, you know, monument for particularly an appropriate war memorial.
All right. Let's talk with a caller in Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Yes. One little note on the last part of the conversation, that there was controversy about a female Asian artist who designed that. Am I right in that?
Absolutely, yeah. She was Chinese-American, and that became part of the controversy.
Yes, and it was pretty hot during that time. My call's about, I live here in Effingham, Illinois, the last couple years, and we have on the near the intersection of I-70 and 57, a 198-foot-tall cross, multi-sided, so it can appear full frontal on whatever direction you're approaching it. And they lowered it to 198 because otherwise it had a red light on it, which is kind
of... like they have at the top of the Washington Monument.
Right. And so it weighs 180 tons of steel. And Effingham's largely German community and Catholic, and I think that played into it. But there again, it is a Christian monument, and that's where I take a little bit of issue. You know, I'm trying to remember the word for the Islamic, the moon and star. What do they call that?
You refer to it as a crescent, I think. Yeah.
Yes, the crescent. Well, aren't other things like that, shouldn't they be welcome as well? You know, I understand where I live and all the ramifications of prejudice and hatred. But here, you know, America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, you know, and multicultural, it kind of pushes all that aside with this monument to Christianity, which is fairly new, you know, to humanity. So I just wondered what you thought about that. And thank you, David.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yes. Well, you know, that has been an issue that has arisen in different contexts, a few different contexts in the erection of public monuments. You know, what kind of religious symbolism will be placed on them? In World War I and World War II cemeteries in Europe, for example, there are kind of standard headstones with crosses on them. I know that issue has arisen in that as well, there as well. So, and there are, of course, in Washington, D.C., there are quite a few monuments that have explicitly either Christian imagery or, I think more often, actually kind of Christian texts in them, texts that reference Christianity in one way or the other. and so, you know, this... partly, I think your question is about, you know, one thing that this draws attention to is how monuments get erected and who's really in charge of erecting public monuments. It's not, strictly speaking, a truly democratic process. I mean, but it is a process that reflects usually the majority, you know, in local communities or a national community. So, minority religions, for example, are not going to find themselves expressed typically in public space and in the forum of public monuments, which tend to go, you know, to the dominant, whatever the dominant culture's view of things is. And we saw you see this even with ethnic groups. There, in over the course of the history of the United States, there were some ethnic groups that were able to kind of become players in public space and erect monuments to themselves. Say, Italian-Americans in the 20th century are very successful in erecting monuments to Columbus, for example, and there are 150 Columbus monuments around the United States. By the way, actually, a fairly significant minority of those Columbus monuments show Columbus holding a Christian cross. So that would be one example that I could give to you. But if we contrast that, the success of Italian Americans with the relative lack of success of African Americans in public space, who had essentially no visibility whatsoever in public monuments in public space before the Civil Rights Movement, and it's only since the Civil Rights Movement that African American groups have actually had a voice, really, in the construction of public monuments. And so now, you know, we have the Martin Luther King Memorial, for example, being erected in Washington, D.C. But that kind of monument was inconceivable before the Civil Rights Movement. So it's only certain groups that actually have the ability to erect monuments in the first place that have the resources and the authority to do so.
We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus. Our guest is Kirk Savage. He's professor or chair of the Department of Art and Architecture at University of Pittsburgh, and he is the author of the book Monument Wars, published by University of California Press, that looks at the history, the development of the National Mall in Washington, D.C., but also explores the kinds of questions we've been talking about here this morning, questions of why it is that people put up monuments and how they relate to them. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. I would like to have you talk a little bit about the National World War II Memorial, because at the time, certainly I remember at the time that it was proposed and people were showing the designs, there was a lot of controversy about this, both in terms of the projected placement, where it would be, and also the design.
Yeah,
and I think a lot of people thought, you know, given the kinds of trends in monument design that we've talked about, like the Vietnam Wall or the Korean Veterans Monument, this seemed like it was something out of another time.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I sort of think of the World War II Memorial as a kind of nostalgic throwback to an earlier time. In many ways, I think it was planned as the antithesis, as the kind of almost a point-by-point response to counter-response to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. So whereas that's underground and that's, you know, below ground level and black, this is above ground and white, and the Vietnam Veterans Memorial is kind of quiet and intimate. The World War II Memorial is big and noisy with fountains that make it, you know, that roar so loudly that you can barely have a conversation there. So whereas people, you know, give offerings at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, those are actually forbidden at the World War II Memorial and so on. So you're right, it was very controversial when it was being erected. The chief point of the biggest point of controversy was the site, because it was the first monument to be located actually on the center line of the National Mall, since the mall had been cleared and completed in the 1930s. No memorial had been erected in the vista between the Grant Memorial and Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial, those big three monuments that occupied the center line of the mall. So the World War II Memorial was situated right on that center line, and there was a lot of controversy about that and about how it was going to block the vista and maybe even block the circulation of people along the mall. And there was also controversy about its design, its neoclassical style, which many people argued was reminiscent of fascism and fascist architectures. They said, why are we building a World War II memorial that looks like a Nazi German war memorial or a Nazi German structure. So in my opinion, the objections to its location on the center line of the mall, I think, are still valid. I think that it has, in fact, impeded circulation. It's a cul-de-sac. The World War II Memorial is a cul-de-sac. You cannot walk from the Washington Monument through the memorial to the reflecting pool and the Lincoln Memorial behind, because you are blocked by the wall of the World War II Memorial. So you actually have to backtrack and go back out the monument and around. So it has, in fact, interrupted the free passage of movement between the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial that had existed, you know, on the mall since the 1930s. But beyond that, I think my own personal reaction to the World War II Memorial had a lot to do with the fact that it brings back, or actually seems to be in many ways speaks to the era of the 21st century, of the first decade of the 21st century. I think in many ways this monument has a lot to do with the War on Terror and the era of the Bush presidency. And in fact, Bush's George Bush's name is in fact on the monument very conspicuously at the entrance to the World War II Memorial, which is again a kind of unprecedented, something that's rather unprecedented in Washington, D.C.
We have a couple of minutes left. Let's take another caller. Bloomington, Illinois is up next, line 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
I've really been enjoying your show. One of the things I wanted to mention was here in Bloomington, we have two very amusing sculptures that really even attract children to them. One is Lincoln sitting on a park bench outside of our local history museum, and the other is in the airport of Adlai Stevenson, sitting on a bench with his suitcase and his one leg folded over the other with the hole in the sole of his shoe.
Uh-huh.
And I think, you know, and they're very nice, but they attract children. I mean, they're really neat because they have a very human scale, and the kids seem to really, at least my grandchildren, just, you know, it's like, oh, we're downtown, we have to see this, or, oh, we're going to the elevator, we have to go say hello to that statue. I don't know. They still don't know who Adlai Stevenson is, but they think
right.
It's a really neat picture, a really neat statue.
Yeah, that trend of putting putting statues low to the ground, or even actually directly on the ground or on a bench, is again something that really starts in the late 20th century, and it's another one of those the aspects of the shift away from the old model of the hero up on the pedestal. A whole history of the pedestal could be done, which would in itself be fascinating because it would show the ways in which pedestals get lowered and statues come down close to the ground, and they invite that interaction, you know, with you.
I think it's really neat. I think it's really neat. And I do want to have to look at your thing because it's been years now, and I haven't been to Washington since the World War II Memorial has gone in. But there are some amazing things in Washington with the memorials. And I find it very interesting to talk about a human scale. Wasn't it Franklin Roosevelt who said he didn't want a memorial any larger than a desk?
Yes.
So they gave him one, and then they built this other huge thing, which is really neat. But I still think there's a certain charm and a certain symbol of his character.
Yeah, well, that's a further development, which is the increasing magnitude of these. You know, the FDR memorial is about 7 acres, if I remember correctly, and the World War II memorial is also quite large. What happens when monuments become spaces rather than objects, things on pedestals, is that spaces get bigger and bigger and bigger. So that's another trend that we are dealing with right now.
Well, and again, I want to thank the caller. I think that's a really interesting example of how things have changed. The FDR Memorial, in that you have the statue of Mr. Roosevelt, and Fala, the dog, is there with him. So there's that. But also we have the statuary showing men in a bread line.
Right. Right. So yeah, you have a lot of really interesting things happening in that memorial. You have recognition of the kind of the historical traumas of that period of time, you know, the Great Depression and so on. And you also have a lot of interesting messages about war, and they're kind of some of Roosevelt's pacifist messages about war are on that memorial as well. So it's a real complex kind of series of environments that you actually walk through and you interact with the sculpture. Again, which is mostly at ground level, just like our last caller said.
Yeah. We'll see if we get one more caller here, someone local, line 1. Hello.
I comment on if something bad happens in a building that's torn down, and 2, at a certain university nearby at the art department, an artist put up a huge concrete block intending it to sink into the ground over time, and the maintenance department said, no, you have to put it on a slab.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that reminds me of the there's a famous project in Germany in which there was an obelisk erected, a small obelisk erected, which was lowered into the ground over a period of several years as people wrote their own graffiti on it. And this was called a counter monument, and it's one of an example of a whole series of this of a whole phenomenon called the counter-monument phenomenon, where people erect monuments that are actually meant to disappear or meant or are meant not to be seen. So that concrete block that would gradually sink into the ground, would be an example of that. And they're often, like as in the case that you're describing, they're often to mark events that have been, you know, deeply painful or traumatic in some way. And so instead of erecting a kind of triumph, an old-fashioned monument that would have associations of heroism and triumph, they're trying to find a new kind of language, design language, for coming up with a different form of monument that will change over time and that may even disappear.
We have about a minute. Very quickly, are there plans for a 9/11 monument of some kind on the malls? On the Mall in Washington?
It's been talked about, and I hear rumors or read proposals from time to time, but there isn't anything official that I know of. There's no official project underway at this moment, but it's, again, it's an example of something that I think sooner or later may very well arise, and the space, of the Mall, planners are actually trying to sort of seal it off from further monument building. Well, the problem is that then new things happen and people's ideas about history change, and you can't really keep a monumental space like the Mall fixed forever. It just won't work,
Yeah. Our guest is Kirk Savage. He's professor and chair of the Department of Art and Architecture at the University of Pittsburgh. He is the author of the book Monument Wars, Washington, D.C., the National Mall, and the Transformation of the Memorial Landscape. It's published by the University of California Press. And Professor Savage, thank you very much.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciated the questions and the chance to talk with you.
Very good.